Майко.
Бужбаш?
Привіт, мако. Приходь до нас.
Hello, dear listeners of Common Voices. It's a multilingual radio from migrants, about migrants, but not only for migrants. I remember in the beginning of 2022, when we Ukrainians tried to talk to our family and friends in Russia, how it was trying to share our reality. In the end, most of us had to just cross out the people from our lives. They stopped existing for us, just like our lived experience of being bombed and fleeing, the torture, the murder and occupation would not exist to them. They just refused to believe us, to take in our painful reality. I remember how my Russian then friend, after we had a video call, told me, this can't be true, Russia can't be doing that. At the same time, she was sharing videos of Chinese ministers saying that there were some US American bio labs in Ukraine. As you might remember, this was one of the excuses for Russia to start the full-scale war against Ukraine. But this war hasn't started in 2022. The kinetic war, the so-called armed conflict, has been on since 2014. And the cognitive war, so the war for what we believe in, how we think, our identification, how we see Russia as our neighbor, this has been on for centuries. But the real methodology, with the real methodology and strategy since World War II, probably when Goebbels' propaganda manual was translated into Russia, this is when it really started. The methods vary, but their goal is one: to confuse the target audience, manipulate the reality, make the truth, the real facts irrelevant, just like it has been inside Russia since Cold War times. In Russian info space, it is constantly being fed with numerous versions of the events, from totally wild, like Ukrainian nationalists eat Russian babies after crucifying them, to the very sounding very true, like Ukrainian military killed a Russian mayor in Donetsk, and many versions in between. From what my cousin's husband in Russia, a historian by degree, back in 2014 told me, they just don't know what to believe in anymore. This is called a fire hose of falsehood tactic. In a large number of messages, it is when a large number of messages are being broadcast rapidly, repetitively, and continuously over multiple channels without the regard to the truth or consistency. It must be very disorienting, very confusing. I can imagine that you just eventually give up looking for truth and just become a docile citizen who does what you're being told to do. You stop asking questions and, of course, looking for answers. It must feel very heavy for those for whom the reality is the truth, still important, who still ask questions and try to find answers. On the other hand, it must be very easy for those who prefer the more childish position of having the father ruler who tells you what to do, what to think, what to do with your life, and even how to think. When your train of thought is being manipulated, I think it's scary if you think about it. It feels very intrusive, like they're in your head. Of course, it makes me remember Orwell and of modern-day Russia and China. Living under authoritarian regime is life in constant fear. I guess the manipulation of thought is when you're afraid to think some things, or when you try to convince yourself that you agree with something that you're being told to and even succeed in that, or when you try to convince yourself that something is important or not important to you personally. You learn to censor your thoughts and to police them. My name is Anastasia, and today I am here to talk to you about the truth and the reality under attack. In May, I visited Lviv Media Forum, and it was an international three-day conference in Lviv, Ukraine. Basically, the whole 3 days, people from all over the world, EU, Taiwan, the US, different African countries, Brazil, Bosnia, Iran, and of course Ukraine, and we were all there thinking and sharing our practical experiences, looking for answers in the researches, to the questions what we media people and our societies in general should do to protect our reality, democracy, and the freedom of thought, not just speech. What is reality? What is the truth? Is there such thing as objective reality or truth to begin with? Do we need to fight for it all? If so, how do we resist the authoritarian threat of China in Taiwan, Russia in Eastern Europe, the whole Europe? How do we win this cognitive war, the war for our minds and hearts? What is the role of media in shaping the reality and building society in general? But before we dive in, let's hear
a Ukrainian schlager called Chervona Ruta that was played at the after party. It has been probably the second most popular song in Ukraine after the national anthem. Chervona Ruta was written by Volodymyr Ivasyuk, a famous Ukrainian singer and composer that lived in the second half of the past century. On his 30th year of life, full of plans and energy, he was tortured to death by KGB and hung on a tree in the suburbs of Lviv, where he lived and worked. 10,000 people came to his funeral, and his legacy is still alive.
Ти признайся мені, тільки в тебе ті чари, я без тебе всі дні у полоні печалі, може, десь у лісах під часілля шукала, сонце руду знайшла і мене щарувала. Бачу я тебе сяй, у діброва зелене, до звуких смішка, ти приходиш до мене, і не треба не спить, де ні квітку надій, бо давно вже ти увійшло в мої мрії. Шукає вечорами, ти у мене єдина, тільки ти. Повір, бо твоя рода, твоя чиста вода, твоя бистрая вода синій. Шукає вечорами, ти у мене єдина, тільки ти. Повір, бо твоя правда, твоя чиста вода, твоя бистрая вода синій. Твоя бистрая вода синій.
Your reality is being constantly under attack. So what do we do about it? This was the question of the conference post. Should we fight, freeze, or flee?
People reduced to the status of objects that can be manipulated and are incapable of making their own choices, cannot interact freely, cannot fully and consciously create a shared reality, and do not feel responsible for it. Ukraine is now trying to defend a different worldview, where the fundamental value is the human being, their freedom and respect for them. Where we are responsible for our worlds, for our shared world, and for one another. And it is precisely this worldview that we are trying to embody in our reality, which we are defending in this war. In truth, we can neither flee nor freeze when our reality is under attack, because our reality is us. Because by fleeing or freezing, if we ever were to do so, we would continue to create a reality, but a completely different one, a reality of defeat, where we would have renounced our freedom and our fundamental values. Yet we would not be free of responsibility for it.
Yeah, Maxim Butkevich believes that we have to fight for the reality because this is our world, our life. And Kolos Yotaka from Taiwan shares also, agrees with him and shares how they fight back the Chinese disinformation against Taiwan.
So when reality is under attack, what can we do? Of course, you have to fight for it. You don't run away. To be silenced cannot help to decrease any conflicts at all. Actually, last year, in 2025, 1 year, China has been sending aircrafts more than 5,000 times coming to Taiwan, and half of them already passed the median line, cross strait, Taiwan Strait. So China has been pressing closer and closer. We are already in a war, an information war, cognitive warfare. The misinformation, disinformation has been spreading, and all kinds of Taiwan is part of China narratives has been spreading, not only all over the island, but all over the world. And if countries are quiet about it, then of course you can proceed further. Our democracy is under attack. We have to fight and speak strongly to clarify those misinformation, to tell people what's the truth, what's the reality. But we have to compete with the time. We have to compete with the integrity, and we have to compete of the public mindsets to teach people to have a public education that the fake news is there. We have to be careful.
Kolos Yotaka is the Taiwanese author, researcher, activist for indigenous people of Taiwan. She used to manage governmental communication during COVID-19 pandemic, worked as a journalist. Now Kolos hosts a podcast about security, foreign affairs, and democratic resilience. For your information, Taiwan is a former colony of China and still carries China in its name. So the official name is Republic of China, not to be confused with the People's Republic of China, the China itself. The situation here is very similar to how Krim is perceived and being communicated by Russia, but it was given to Ukraine by Khrushchev. You can hear, I heard this many times. And there was a referendum, yeah, like with Russian military in the streets and buses full of foreigners who came to vote, so to say, at the referendum. Krim's indigenous populations are Krim Tatars, also known as Krimli, Karaims, and Krimchaks. They are being persecuted more than others on their home peninsula. So in Taiwan, they came up with a brilliant instrument to fight disinformation. They tried to work with large language models because humans cannot combat all these algorithms and bots and all the misinformation out there in the broad internet. So the Taiwanese bots look for specific hatred wording in all of their dialects and languages to communicate with the Chinese bots and identify their IPs. I mean, why not? The kinetic war has been using mostly drones and robots. It's time to use the machines in the cognitive war as well. Darena Pidhorna, a legal activist, an analyst at Raphael Lemkin Society, believes that fighting disinformation doesn't work and suggests that we need to have our own narrative.
In talks of narratives, the very one that we need really to pay attention to what the Russia is talking about. We need to pay attention to what we are talking about, because the idea of counter-narrative is quite not an effective idea. We need to think about what our narrative inside of us, because only creating our own narrative, we can counter their narratives. We can think about how to approach them, how to fight with them, how to win the battle in this complicated, historical, whatever war you may call it.
Rafael Lemkin was a Polish-Jewish lawyer who studied in Lviv, and he coined the term genocide. And destruction of cultural heritage is a part of the term he coined. So Daryna continues his work, centering her own work around protection of cultural heritage, the right to truth, and broader issues of memory and transitional justice. Daryna says we need to pay attention to what Russian narrative is and create our narrative, because counter-narrative is not effective. I believe the same is with the AfD and other authoritarian regimes. Honestly, I've been having the feeling that Antifa movement has been lacking something, and I couldn't quite point my finger at it. I guess that just being against the AfD is not enough. There was something wrong. There is something wrong in this narrative. AfD equals Nazi equals evil. We are left. We are the good. In the Antifa movement, I like the vision of the future narrative. Not just what to fight against, but also what to fight for. Like in Fridays for Future, they had pretty clear demands about the future, I would say. I mean, the name is For Future. They've been fighting not only against climate crisis, but also for climate justice. So we, the good guys, we need to learn what is the future we want to build.
The media literacy, as we can imagine it, is outdated as a phone with buttons. So it is not something useful. When it comes to what we really need, we don't need to check the source anymore. We don't need to check. We can check it. But the first step we should do, and actually not just once, we should redo it, I don't know, weekly, monthly. We have to understand who we are and with whom we are. We need to work on the tribe. We need to work on our identity. As when we are getting into reaction to facts, we understand that the perception of fact is being influenced by the group we are with, by the identity we are sharing. And that's why when we are also very, very simply trying to figure out the main targets of cognitive warfare, we can see as a top priority social cohesion. So this is something that is being under attack. Of course, trust, of course, legitimization.
You've just heard Dr. Solvita Denisa Lipenica. She is the head of Strategic Communication and Coordination Department in the State Chancellery of Latvia. This is a communications She's a communication scholar specializing in strategic communication and cognitive resilience. She served as a visiting scholar in New York University's Jordan Center for the Advanced Studies of Russia. Solvita believes that we need to work on our identity, our tribe, because our perception of facts is very much influenced by our identity. Yeah, countering disinformation doesn't really work, like fake debunking. I've heard this before, that mostly only journalists read fake debunking because lies travel faster than the truth. Fakes normally are more emotional than the truth. They just feel more true, and the initial information sticks with you better than the one you've received later. This is just how we work, the humans work. The same works for conspiracy theories. And the deeper the person is in their belief, the harder it is for them to change their mind. Aida Tavakoli is a Franco-Iranian long-term human rights activist focusing on the Middle East.
The most dangerous simplification that we are actually all faced to is the dual perspective, is the belief that we are either against or for something, that there are only two options, being pro-war or against war, being pro-leftist or against leftist, being pro-US and democracy or against, you know, it's, and I think the reality under attack is because the reality is so much more complex than that. It's so much more complex than just two options. The reality actually is under attack because we are not willing anymore to grasp complexity and the multitude and diversity of perspective that actually build our reality. My reality is not the same as yours, and it's not the same as each one of you in the room. But if we are not willing to share our perspective and to hear the perspective that is not ours, then we will never get closer to what reality is. And I think this dual perspective, this simplification, is due to our natural, I would say, temptation to find very simple answer to complicated questions. Because we want to go fast, because we want to have quickly the solution to very complex matter. And because we are hurt, because this violence in the world is so painful, so unbearable for so many people. So we want it to end quickly. We want to have this magical solution, this magical hero. So then we just build two teams, the good guys and the bad guys. And the enemy of my enemy will become my friend. And I will not look at the reality of this friend. Is he really my friend? Does he really want to help me? I will just put him in my team because he's against the team that I'm fighting against, you know? So this simplification, unfortunately, I think, fuels the violence in the world. It fuels the conflict. And it doesn't allow us to get any idea of the complexity of the reality we are living in. And it also stops the entire process of building reality together. Reality is not something static. It's not something that we can have in our mind and be sure of it, and then it doesn't move, and we do not need to question it. And the only thing that we need to do is convince the others that this is the reality. That doesn't work like this. The reality that I have today is a starting point, and I hope that it's not going to be the same in 5 days, and it's not going to be the same in 10 years, because I hope that I will have enough perspective nourishing my reality so it gets closer to what really is. And if we are not ready for this process, if we do not have tools to hear the perspectives that are sometimes even painful to hear, sometimes tremendously scandalous for us to hear, but if we're not ready to have those perspectives as well and try to include them at least one or two points into our own perspective, then we will never find sustainable solutions to the challenges we are facing today.
Aida speaks with much empathy, saying that it's his natural desire in the complex world with so much violence to look for simple answers and divide the world into camps, either with me or against me, the good and the bad, friend or foe. Aida also reminds us that there is no objective reality, one for all, but rather everyone has their own realities. And instead of dividing everything in black and white, we need to share our realities to have a common reality. Her colleague, Gilda Sahebi, another Iranian female journalist, but in Germany, wrote a book, Verbindung statt Spalten, eine Antwort auf Politik der Spaltung, joining, uniting instead of dividing, the answer to politics of dividing. There she also calls for the readers to not give in to the idea that all those who do not share your worldview are bad, and the cause of all the problems is in the world, these people who are different from you. I started reading it, and I believe everyone has to also to read it, especially before the election in Sachsen-Anhalt. But after, it's also not too late. I'm afraid that the division in German society, in European society, is getting even stronger. That makes me anxious, honestly, and sad, because this is exactly what autocrats like Putin, Khamenei, Xi Jinping, and Trump, and Kim, and Co, this is what they want. They want to weaken the democracy so that they can establish autocracy. They want to take away our freedom. And on the verge of Ukraine's Independence Day, I just want to remind the listeners who were born and grew up in physical peace and freedom that you need to protect it. You don't know what it is until you're losing it. And no, freedom of speech doesn't mean you can speak lies and manipulations. Freedom of speech means that you need to protect the truth and the right to say it. It is very easy to lose and very hard to win back. The strategy is ancient, dividae et impera, divide and rule. It's been polished over the centuries with the modern instruments like social media and generative AI, or rather large language models. People so often believe in fakes and distrust official media. One might think that people normally don't want the truth because it's uncomfortable. And interesting that most speakers on the panel agree with this. So Peter Pomerantsev, an award-winning author, refers to the past century Americans, journalist Walter Lippmann and philosopher, psychologist and education reformer John Dewey, who debated on the same topic already a century ago.
Truth is horrible. Truth tells us that we're going to die at the end of the day. Truth tells us that we've probably failed in most of the things we wanted to achieve. Most of our life is spent running away from truth. But truth is quite useful if you want to get things done. The idea that people thirst for the truth is not true. I mean, let's be honest. The historical record of media being the channel towards reality is quite weak. Walter Lippmann did a very famous study of the New York Times. This is in 1917, 1820. And showed that the stories of the New York Times about the Russian Revolution were continuously inaccurate and full of bias. And the conclusion that Lippmann came to was, instead of bringing us closer to reality, mass media takes us away from reality. Not because of cynicism, not because of propaganda, but because of human nature. Walter Lippmann came up with the idea of the stereotype, the idea that people cannot deal with complexity. The world is too difficult and too complex. And so they will reduce complexity to cliches, to stereotypes, to views of the world that make them feel comfortable. And media, instead of breaking that, is complicit in it because it needs to sell newspapers, because the journalists believe it. So we have a system of a desire to escape from reality and media reinforcing that. And his conclusion famously was that democracy will not work because if there is no way for us to confront reality, we can't have a public debate, and therefore we will always make bad decisions. And he basically said, this was the 1920s, that we need a technocratic elite to rule us, who will confront reality because they're spiritually more mature and make decisions for reality. So he's sort of the godfather of technocracy. So at the same time, he comes out with this very famous book called The Phantom Public. He comes up with this idea of the stereotype. And he starts this incredible debate with the most important philosopher of the time, John Dewey. And John Dewey agrees with Walter Lippmann. He says, you're quite right. People want to escape reality. Media complicit in taking people away from reality. But, says John Dewey, what you're proposing, Walter Lippmann, the idea that a technocratic elite will rule us, is even worse, because there is nothing stopping this elite from falling into the same traps and making exactly the same mistakes. So what John Dewey proposes is what he calls the great community. It starts from a philosophical idea that we cannot know truth, that truth is too hard to know, but truth can emerge from lots of people looking for it, debating one another, and coming and testing ideas of the truth. And he came up with an idea of an America full of small local media, civil society, researchers, all debating the truth, all discussing it, all making mistakes, but together as a project, letting truth emerge, which was kind of the romantic idea of American media and civil society for a long time. We had lots of local media and NGOs and academics and a few big media. He was very against big media. He thought they were always a disaster. That was sort of John Dewey's vision. And I think he would be horrified by the world of sort of giant algorithms and giant media. But this debate was already happening at the start of the 20th century. And in many ways, we're having it again now.
Peter Pomerantsev is exploring the relationships between propaganda, culture, and society. Peter researches how challenges of disinformation and polarization in the digital age he was born in Kyiv under Soviet occupation, and his parents, being journalists and dissidents, had to flee to the UK. Now Peter continues the work of his father and collaborates closely with Ukrainian journalists and sociologists. I can only agree with John Dewey and Peter that having tech bros ruling our society is a horrible idea. Yevhen Hlibovitsky agrees with Peter that people don't want the truth because it's uncomfortable, but he believes that we still need to embrace the world's complexity in order to survive.
So the things that we were thinking were good turned out not to be good. The things that we were thinking were bad turned out not to be bad. This is why we need the sobriety. When I'm talking about agency, this means the ability to think in a complicated, in a sophisticated way. The ability to deal with complexity, to question yourself, to have doubt. Autocracy is a terrible background for doubts. Autocracy requires very visible comprehension, very visible alignment with the whatever the political ruling is. But at the same time, understanding how toxic autocracy is, I can imagine a situation, say, if Ukraine is failed by the partners, that to survive, there will be no other option for Ukraine but to radicalize and turn autocratic. And then the question is, what is the alternative? For us, it's disappearing. Russians are not about territory. Russians are not about human capital. The Russians actually are trying to erase us from history. Was this the case with other nations and identities in Europe? Say the Occitans, for instance, or the Catalans. Would this be possible if both Russia and Ukraine would be in the European Union? Would the European umbrella be strong enough to protect countries from sliding into autocracy? These are great questions. We have no idea whether it would. We have no idea whether the European concept is able to withstand the pressures. Look at the Lisbon Treaty. It starts with a list of values. If you take these values and apply them to each of the European country member, there will be more than one country that does not comply. And there will be countries beyond the European Union that comply better. And this actually produces these shades of gray, these smokes and mirrors that make it very difficult to give very definite answers to sophisticated questions. This is why I think we have to understand that if we want to survive, and I think the risks are tremendous, I'm looking at what's happening with the AI. So the thing is, if we approach this way, we actually may end up in a situation that is very unmodern in perception. The modernism brought us the idea that we're going to be okay. No, not necessarily. We can die. All of us can die, and we can die painfully in a terrible way. So if we do not have the fear that this might be the end, then we don't get the sense of urgency to transform things. What Ukraine does and what Ukraine sees, being a nation on the frontier, we know that the price of every mistake will be terrible. And because of this, even though we are not adults, we are a very infantile nation, we have the joys and the troubles that our Mediterranean culture brings to us, you know, and we are messy, we are chaotic, we don't like structure. But we understand very clearly one thing. If we mess this thing up, there will be no one to bury the bodies.
Yevhen Hlibovitsky is a Ukrainian public intellectual, a strategic consultant. With his journalistic background, he is also in the advisory board of Suspilne, Ukraine's public broadcaster and one of the best media in Ukraine. Although a Bosnian human rights activist in Czechia, Igor Blažević, disagrees with the man who spoke before because he believes that it's not that people don't want the truth. It's that they want dignity and respect, and this is why the media has to connect with their audiences and show respect to them. Going back to complexity, at Lviv Media Forum, the Taiwanese delegation has also shared that in Taiwan, they have this issue with simplified narratives, and they haven't really figured out how to cover complicated questions, the dividing ones. A very common narrative there is that US equals war, China equals peace. The same thing shared the Georgian journalists. Their pro-Russian authoritarian party, Georgian Dream, also plays on the on the fear of war, that the EU hasn't managed to protect Ukraine, and now it wants to drag Georgia into the war. And Russian narratives are that the enemies all around. Yeah, like 19th century enemies, the Ottoman Empire, Azerbaijan and Turkey, but not Russia, considering that 20% of Georgian territory is occupied and there are Russian troops. At the after party, I asked some people, what do we do when the truth becomes irrelevant and when people don't want to know it? This was the main question with which I came to the conference. Some half a year ago, I had a conflict with a close person. We were sitting home watching TV, and then I see her reaching out for her phone to check out the notification. It turned out to be the news about Ukraine bombing Kremlin. I was immediately suspicious about it. Back then, it was too good to be true. And I guess the source was the anonymous Telegram channel sharing true and fake news that she's been reading, following for a while. I expressed my disbelief because, and perhaps mixed with judgment, and what she said was, I don't care if it's true or not, I just want to have some joy. And we had a row in the end. She called also journalistic media whores. I was offended because this is my profession since I joined Corex 10 months ago. And I know the hard work of producing high quality content and the fact checking and everything. But for her, I was a fun breaker. Ida's answer resonated with me the most.
When human beings are faced with so much trauma and so much pain, psychologically, you do not want to hear about the challenge ahead. You don't want to hear about perspectives that are invalidating your own opinion or your wishful thinking. But I think it's just one step, you know, it's the first stage in which we are all at some point of our lives. In 2022, when the Women Life Freedom movement started in Iran, I did not want to hear anyone telling me, Aida, the Islamic regime is not going to fall in 3 months, because this is what I needed to believe. But I needed to believe that for 3 months. It doesn't mean that the person you're talking about, it doesn't mean that she will never change her mind. It means that at that precise moment of her life, she is not ready to see another perspective. But maybe through listening to her, through questioning and making bonds and talking about other subjects, the space for other perspective can open. And then, little by little, you get ready to know that what you've wished for is not exactly the reality or the truth. And what is reality is what you have to take into account so you can change it into what you wish for. This is a process. We should never get desperate because someone disagrees with us or doesn't want to know the truth or because the facts do not matter. Of course, they do not matter. Now, today, at that precise moment. But then, if you have a true conversation, if you have a sincere space in which you can make the other person evolve, then you can both actually change your perspective. It's just about introducing the dynamic instead of just staying in the static perspective.
Ida says reality might not matter at this particular moment, but we need to connect and have trust. To build trust in the relationship. Reality, it's something that we can work with to change it into what we wish for. She really touched my heart. But Peter Pomerantsev suggests a systemic approach in waging the cognitive war.
They've spent 30 years of building up an echo chamber. It's a whole world. So they created a whole ecology of factual information. They had some think tanks of opinion journalism and then ways of conquering the online space as well. The online space was designed in a very specific way to pull the media in a certain direction. You constantly attack the media and make them go your way. I think we have to be much more about undermining the systems of the propagandists, not just the content. How do we undermine their funding model, technology, sometimes even the people who work there? We should be thinking in terms of counterintelligence and subversion, because the other side think that about us. They go after our funding models, our presence on the internet. There's a lot of work to do, but I don't think it's the job of traditional journalists to suddenly become something else. I think they should do their job, and I think we should protect and help and elevate. great people Thank like you. You. But then we should think of, okay, so what's the role of influencers? What's the role of influencing the algorithms? You know, if that's the game we live in, sadly, for the moment we live in that game, we have to think about that. If the other side is doing LLM poisoning, how do we do LLM detoxification? So we have to think in terms of an ecology. How is that creating a Dewey's idea of a great community? And we fail to do that because we're still operating as if this is some textbook mid-1990s scenario where we will let 1,000 flowers bloom, plant little seeds here, a little bit in academia, a little bit in media, a little bit in activism, and let it all bloom. We are facing an adversary, illiberal forces throughout the world who approach the information environment like a war. So they're fighting while we are still living in a kind of idea of perpetual peace. So actually we would activate our values if we were to start treating this like the crisis that it is. And I think if anybody is ahead on this, it's Ukraine, which has been conscious of being in a literal war, but also we see it in Moldova. We saw it in Hungary just now, and we see it in Taiwan. All the victories that have been made have been from people recognizing that this is a completely different battlefield. So there are some hard choices to be made when that starts, but this is the great disbalance. One side treats this like a war, where they use all their assets together for a single political aim, and we don't. So what happens when we take humanitarian lawyers, journalists, sociologists, and now increasingly we work with influencers, take them together in order to achieve justice? We're going to have to learn how to work together for a greater effect. If the kinetic part of the war pauses, Russia will then push everything towards hybrid and information. Then we go from the Second World War to the Cold War, and Russia will redouble its efforts into Ukraine, and it'll be easier in some ways to do that. More importantly, Russia will start pushing much more aggressively to the things they've let slide a little bit into the Caucasus. They're going to everything to destabilize Europe and surround Ukraine and break unity, which is what happened in the Cold War. And it'll be easier for them to make progress on that when there isn't a kinetic war. Because when they're bombing Ukraine, that always builds some sort of solidarity across Europe. But that'll stop, and they're going to be pushing like crazy to surround us and to destabilize us. Now, in the Cold War, the pushback came from America. America created Radio Free Europe. America was the machine that fought back in a strategic way on the cultural, information, diplomatic, and other fronts. We know that's not going to happen again. Who is going to be the power that fights with Russia and its many allies on the information, cognitive, financial hybrid fronts? I love the EU, the way you love granny who makes you a nice soup sometimes. But like, I mean, it can't get down the political stairs without like 10 people holding it. We can bring it out for a wedding. It has a lot of money, like that granny, so it's useful. But in terms of political will, in terms of a war, it's not the right partner. So it's going to be Ukraine, a few more partners. We're going to have to create the new Radio Free Europe. We're going to have to be the center for the fight back. So the new cultural information hegemon in this region will be centered around Ukraine with a few more partners. We're going to have to be doing influence into the Caucasus, into Central Asia, collaborating throughout Central Europe. And we need to start preparing now, creating the networks for that now. We need to start winning the technological race on that now. But we have to understand if there is a kinetic pause, the information war increases by thousands of percent. And we really need to start planning now because the other side is way ahead.
I love Peter's sense of humor, how he speaks of the EU, like a favorite granny whom you love for her soup and money. But to bring her up the political stairs, it's just nearly impossible. My colleague, a German citizen herself, when she just heard this, found it rather chilling. Well, me being Ukrainian, I love this analogy with an old lady. I'm very much used to dark humor. This is one of the things that helped me survive in this genocide, like not to go crazy. There is a funny story with Peter. To the conference, I brought two of his books that I've read with the great pleasure. So one is This Is Not a Propaganda, and the other is How to Win the Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler. So here comes my turn in the line of his fans waiting for his signature. And I tell him, your books have inspired me to go into communication. And Peter's like, I'm so sorry. You should better go read some business books. I tell him, well, I tried. It didn't work. He says, I'm just joking, I'm flattered, and poses happily for the photo with me. Yeah, but basically all the speakers until now have stressed that we must all work together and embrace the complexity of the world, because this is the only way to protect the truth and from the authoritarian regimes who make this irrelevant. Russia's goal since the last century has been to destabilize, demoralize, make the truth irrelevant. In the past century, they were selling the world the great communist utopia. Now they are selling the Russian world, Русский мир. This is a great Russian culture that is like a couple centuries old and is no greater than any other culture in the world, but was the only culture allowed to thrive in the Russian Empire, including Soviet Union. Mir in Russian also means peace. So whoever doesn't want the world, the culture, will get the peace, which in fact is war. This is double meaning. Their methodology book of active measures names four phases: demoralize, destabilize, crisis, and normalization. They are actively working on the demoralization and destabilization of Europe. I think in the occupied territories of Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast, they are at the stage of normalization already. Probably in Mariupol, they are too already at the stage of normalization, unfortunately. And of course, there are other colonies. They are like, it's long the normalization, but there are people fighting to destabilize it, to bring it, at least bring it back to the crisis. It's getting back to the crisis with the great help of Ukrainian drones. And before we talk about the fights of the two worlds, here you have another popular Ukrainian song that was played at the after party, Persephone by Vivian Mord.
Meow, meow, meow. самурай, не в змозі зробити собі харакірі. Взяли катани до рук піонери, втілись би їх поважати в старість.
Бідна, бідна Персефона.
Welcome back to Common Voices, a multilingual radio from migrants, about migrants, but not only for migrants. My name is Anastasia, and today I'm talking about the truth and reality being under attack based on the Lviv Media Forum, an international conference in Lviv that I visited in May. In the beginning, you could hear such speakers as Kolos Yotaka from Taiwan, Evgeny Hlibovitsky, and Darina Pidhorna from Ukraine, Peter Pomerantsev from London, Solvita Deniza Lipenitsa from Latvia, Aida Tavakoli originally from Iran. They mostly discussed the main topic of the conference: how do we protect the reality that authoritarian regimes have been manipulating? They've been trying to make it irrelevant, sending tons of disinformation and fakes, trying to demoralize us and make us believe that we don't really want the democratic freedom, and perhaps we'd be better off with them, the autocrats like Russia in Europe and China in Asia. In this section, I'm looking for answers about how not to fall into the trap of autocracy. I found it also very relevant before the decisive election in Sachsen-Anhalt in about a month. We are really facing the threat of falling into the autocracy here. Some people, even in Western democratic countries, begin to doubt whether having all those freedoms is good, whether we need democracy at all. Perhaps a ruling father who is strong and knows it all is better for us. So a visitor of the forum asked the speakers, what should we do when some societies are fighting for democracies, like Ukrainian and most of the speakers, and others are disappointed in it, like the Central Europe? And can Central Europe learn from Eastern Europe? Ida's answer was that we have to learn to live in the disagreement.
And I think the civil societies also forgot the cost of being in a free country. It's not for free. It takes a lot of work to be able to make a society and live in a society where everyone is free of thinking what they want. Because if you are free of thinking what you want and your neighbor can think otherwise, then you need to work to live in the same society as someone who disagrees with you, someone who's different from you, someone who has a different background from you. And you need to bond with them. You need to agree with some very important principles. You need to agree on how you should behave in a society, how you should take care of this space of disagreement. You need to be able to have this non-violent disposition to disagreement, to be able to deactivate all that fuels the violence inside the society. So it's a very fragile fabric, a free society. We do not all agree together. We are not one. We are not just monolithic. And how do you make this unified? The problem that we have is that today, I think in democratic countries, we think that disagreeing with each other means division. And we think that the only solution is unity. For unity is all agreeing together. The only society where everyone agrees is a dictatorship, because there is one person ahead that tells everyone what to think and what to believe in. If you want to live in a free country, then you need to learn how to deactivate the battle with people that do not agree with you, how to have a conversation with them, how to find consensus, how to debate, how to deactivate. activate the battle. And this is the main threat, I think, today in democratic countries. The reason why the polarization and the radicalization is so intense everywhere is because we think that we need to choose a side and then stick to this side and never change our minds, or we will be accused of betraying our
community or our team. You know,
this is not how it works. In a free country, you have many, many perspectives, not just two, and you need to work together to keep this unity and to make emerge new perspectives that are beyond just mine and yours. It's a third one that emerge from our democratic daily practice. And we need to relearn to do this. And social media obviously do not help. Okay. Propaganda does not help. But the only way to resist this way of this vulnerability to choosing a side and sticking to it is relearning to actually be in a democratic country.
Free society is indeed a fragile fabric. Societies like Ukrainian, Georgian, Sakhatvalian, Eastern European countries in general, we know the true cost of freedom. Hungary has lost a lot of its freedom to Orban and hasn't recovered it completely yet. Georgia, too, has been losing more and more freedom to its ruling party, Georgian Dream. Moldova is fighting. Ukraine is fighting for its freedom and independence. This war is officially called in Ukraine the war for independence. We are fighting for it with blood, sweat and tears, literally dying for it. My female friend and my brother, they are somewhere at the moment of the recording near Konstantinivka in the east, most likely. We have not forgotten what it is like not to have freedom. And we are not more divided than the EU or the US, even though Russia has been trying to do that. They haven't succeeded. In fact, they have succeeded in the opposite. They united us, especially in the first years of the full-scale war. Like, our society has never been united like that, I believe, like in 2022. We forgot like all the differences, we put them aside, and we were just like acting like one organism. It was a wonderful feeling. But even now we are not that united. We still go out to the streets together to show our disagreement with our government's actions. We still remember that Russia is our main enemy. Yes, sometimes we can have fierce debates. We call it srach, literally shitstorm online. But in the end of the day, we know we are in it together. Ida said she is amazed at the Ukrainian society, that the debate is still there. The opposition, too, is still there. She believes it's a lesson for the Western civil society, the true cost of freedom. And she's not alone in her amazement. I was actually amazed to hear so many compliments to our media, to our society in general. Most of the people who I talked to, they came here to learn from us. Peter also keeps pointing out that how great it is, that how great we are doing, that EU needs to learn from us. And he agrees with Ida that we have to join forces, our democratic forces, because the autocrats do work together and try to undermine our unity.
Hybrid war, and it's a real war. They take their different levers and use them together for a combined effect. They will commit atrocities that will be followed up or sometimes preempted with propaganda campaigns to undermine the truth of what happens. At the same time, they will be using corruption in strategic countries to undermine accountability, and then intimidating the legal community with cyber attacks, threats, assassinations, and so on. So they're taking their whole toolkit, the kinetic toolkit, atrocities, propaganda, corruption, cyber, sabotage, assassination, in one toolkit for one effect, to create a world where they can do whatever they want and where crime and atrocities are normalized. And that actually works in everything they do. Very good at joining up their tools. We don't do that. And if we ever want to compete, we have to learn how. And that means joining up our democratic tools, investigative journalism, communication, advocacy, legal process, processes. They join up their networks of evil. We join up our networks of good. Our theory of change or our theory of effects is grounded in the mid-1990s, when there was an idea that things would just happen because of a market of institutions. Truth will just out. Journalists will be over here, lawyers over here, cyber defense over here. And that is why, in general, Russia has had such an easy time of advancing its interests across Europe to stop the Russian subversion of the election in Moldova. Each acting independently, each with its own values, but each aware.